And I like to tell Peck, Lars and I had a certain difference in our age. And since I've spent 45 days now traveling 17,500 miles an hour, our age difference is a little closer. And otherwise, pretty much everything that Lars said is true. There's one detail that he left out, which is
Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, which was launched in 1991, on which our work was based. There's two interesting features of that. The first is that the proposal that we wrote for that was a relatively modest proposal in the first round, and it was to use an instrument to look for these X-ray binary pulsars in a mode that hadn't been anticipated by the designers. And we got a very nice referee report that said, basically, since you're asking for such a small amount of money, we'll give it to you, but we don't think you'll find anything. And in the first day of data that we got from the Gamma Ray Observatory, we saw 5 binary pulsars. So that was very exciting for me, and it was wonderful to collaborate with Lars. And you're all very lucky to have him here at the KITP, because he's a lot of fun to work with, but I think you already know that. Our age difference is now closer by about 32 milliseconds due to special relativity, and further apart by about 9, because you stayed on planet Earth, 9 nanoseconds. So what I'd like to do today is tell you a little bit about the great observatories and the Hubble Space Telescope in particular. And I kind of think of the astronaut business as a physicist as being more than space adventure, but more in the human side, the space adventure side. Whereas what the Hubble Space Telescope does is really in the space exploration side. You know, it's our eyes to the universe, and thus the title of the talk. While I was working at Caltech, and the Gamma Ray Observatory was launched, on which essentially my scientific future was based, they headed up in the space shuttle on the end of the robotic arm and were ready to let go of it, and had a small problem. And one of the problems they had with it was that the high-gain antenna, through which all the scientific data would flow, failed to deploy. And so Jay Apt, also a physicist, and Jerry Ross, an Air Force colonel, went out and did a spacewalk, and Jerry Ross grabbed the antenna and pulled it out. And that was one of my introductions to, you know, the very useful side of humans in space. Because prior to that, even though I wanted to be an astronaut since I was about 6 years old, I was still very much skeptical of the human spaceflight program just because of the extreme cost involved. It is a lot of money. Now, you know, if you compare it to other activities like Department of Defense activities, you know, NASA's budget is, equivalent to, if we do go into Iraq, for instance, you know, a few weeks of activity there. So in real terms, it's not a lot of money. But as a physicist, you know, you're always, you know, cheap, experimental physicists in particular, to put it bluntly. So when I saw Jerry Ross essentially save my scientific career, I thought, well, that's pretty neat. I had applied to be an astronaut. I thought, you know, it's very unlikely for any individual to be an astronaut. It's something I dreamed about all my life. But actually, being an astrophysicist is what I loved doing. I couldn't imagine any career when I was at Caltech that would be more fun than being an astrophysicist. And we were just doing neat things with the Very Large Array of Telescopes in Socorro, New Mexico, with optical telescopes in Mount Palomar and elsewhere, the Gamma Ray Observatory, and we were discovering things. And I think that's what's, you know, really wonderful about science and also about space exploration. Well, the great observatories that NASA has flown right now are the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, which has since re-entered the Earth's atmosphere, the Hubble Space Telescope, and the Chandra X-ray Observatory. We have one more in the wings, the Space Infrared Telescope Facility, and that'll launch pretty soon here. And those are the 4 great observatories. Once I became an astronaut, I still wanted to do astronomy or be involved in astronomy. And the Hubble Space Telescope is kind of the holy grail for astronauts, period. But for me as an astronomer, there's no question that being assigned to a Hubble mission was absolutely the top. So I kind of want to tell you that about that adventure today. First of all, let me kind of frame it. You know, why do we have a telescope in orbit? You know, why do we have an HST at all, Hubble Space Telescope? And the answer is a couple of things, one of which, our atmosphere absorbs a lot of light, and that's a good thing, because in particular it absorbs ultraviolet light, or at least a good fraction of it. And if it didn't, we'd all be wearing really wide brim hats, and that, you know, SPF, you know, of 1,000 would be even more important. So if you want to do ultraviolet astronomy, which is looking at hot young stars, and very, very hot phenomena in the universe, you need to have a telescope that's above the atmosphere to see that ultraviolet light. The other thing is, our atmosphere makes stars twinkle. You know, and that's kind of neat. It's very romantic. When you're in space, looking at the stars, they don't twinkle. And so you get much, much sharper images. And so that's one of the other reasons the Hubble Space Telescope is up there. And furthermore, if you want to look at one part of the sky for a really long period of time, you can't do that here on planet Earth because the Earth rotates. So you can track for a while, but eventually some mountain's going to get in the way or the horizon, the sun's going to come up, and that'll be the end of your observing. Putting a telescope in space is very stable. You can observe for long periods of time, and it gives you access to windows of the universe you don't have access to on planet Earth. So that's why we have a Hubble Space Telescope. So what I'd like to do is to show a 17-minute movie. It's kind of a home movie of our mission up to the Hubble Space Telescope last March. We're up for a little over 10 days. And our mission was to increase the discovery potential of the telescope by a factor of 10 and also to renovate a number of systems. So with that, if we can roll the video. We had a crew of 7 people on board STS-109. It was actually the 108th flight of the space shuttle. So if you can hit the... I'll hit play. There we go. It was the 108th mission just because there's one out of order, STS-107, which will go up in January, a research mission. We launched from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. It was a night launch. Our commander, Scott Altman, was on his third flight. He's a Navy pilot. First-time flyer, Duane Carey, Air Force pilot. You know this guy. Nancy Curry was our flight engineer. She's an Army helicopter pilot. Rick Linehan, a veterinarian, was my spacewalking partner. Jim Newman, a physicist on his fourth flight. And Mike Massimino on his first flight. We walk out in those suits. Those are our pressure suits. We call them pumpkin suits. Early in the morning, a couple of hours before launch, and then we climb into the space shuttle. And of course, it's pointing towards the sky. That's a good thing. But it means getting into the seats is a little bit more challenging. And Scott Altman's kind of a big guy anyway. You can imagine trying to get into your minivan if it were pointing up towards the sky. It'd be a little bit different. And most of our training is done on a simulator that's horizontal, so...
T-minus 10, 9, 8,
this is about the point
7,
you start getting a little bit
6,
nervous.
Main engine start. 4, 3,
we're sitting on 4.5 million pounds of explosives.
Liftoff of Space Shuttle 5 to broaden our view of the universe through the Hubble Space Telescope.
At that moment, we're generating just under 8 million pounds of thrust. This is what it looks like from inside.
Full program. Roger, roll, Columbia.
And all you really know is when the solid rocket motors light, you're going somewhere. We went through a cloud deck. We were pre-dawn launch, and all of that light has been generated by the exhaust from the solid rocket motors. I'd never seen a shuttle going through clouds before. It's amazing that you can sense the acceleration by seeing the clouds expanding so much. We ride on the solid rocket motors for about 2 minutes. We kick those off. Those are reusable. They parachute down. A boat pulls them out. This is what staging looks like. And then it gets pretty smooth. You're already above the atmosphere. We were high enough at that point that we actually rode into sunlight. And then magically, 8.5 minutes later, you go from 3 times the acceleration of gravity to free fall, nothing. And anything that's not tied down starts floating. That's our external tank. That was our fuel tank. That re-enters over the Indian Ocean and burns up. Right away, once we got to orbit, we had to start getting to work to get our spacesuits together. We had 7 people in 4 spacesuits, so it was like having 11 people in that little cabin. This is an animation showing how we were going to come up under and rendezvous with the Hubble Space Telescope. A lot of the rendezvous is done on the shuttle's computers. We were a flight of the new suite of avionics on the shuttle with the modern cockpits. We wanted to make sure the Hubble wasn't speeding, so we have a laser gun. And that's part of the rendezvous process, to see separation when we're up close. When we're up close, we call it proximity operations, and that's actually flown manually by the commander. So when we're within a few hundred feet, the commander's flying. And it's a very slow ballet. You don't want to come up too quickly. You don't want to plume the telescope with your jets. And both spacecraft at this point are traveling 17,500 miles an hour. Nancy Curry was also our robotic arm operator as a helicopter pilot. You know, she's very good with that 3D stuff. And so she reached out to grab the telescope. She trained for about a year to do that. So she was especially happy when she got it. But probably not nearly as happy as the four spacewalkers, because if she didn't grab the telescope, we weren't going to go out and do our upgrades. That same day, we had to retract the solar arrays. And that's something that we didn't know how it would go. You can see there's a lot of little waves in these braces here. On the first servicing mission in 1993, they had to throw one of the arrays back into the atmosphere, and it burned up about 4 years later. So we didn't know whether we'd get them rolled up or not. We were replacing the solar arrays with new ones, the whole power system. And fortunately, we did, because I didn't want to have to say, look out below, because we have a space station down there now. So Rick and I suited up for the first spacewalks of five. And over the first 2 days, we were going to replace the entire power system for Hubble. And the power system had been up there for 12 years, and the silicon solar arrays degrade with time. So we were going to put new solar arrays on and a new power box, which I'll describe in just a little bit. We had some neat cameras on board on our helmets that allow you to see exactly what we saw out the top of our helmets. So that's me down there. I'm free-floating. Rick is on the robotic arm with kind of like ski bindings, so he can hold this 450-pound solar array just with the tips of his fingers. So he brought that solar array down. I have a power tool there that allows me to tighten down bolts and things. You don't find that at Home Depot. That one's a little more expensive, but it does work in a vacuum, which is a good thing. And the old arrays rolled up like a Venetian, like a old-style blind, and the new arrays unfold like a book, and they're made out of gallium arsenide, which is a much better, more efficient solar cell and shouldn't degrade as fast in the harsh environment of space, cosmic rays, ultraviolet, and the radiation. Now, this solar array weighs about a third more than the old ones, and it's heavy enough that we weren't allowed to tether to it for safety reasons. So Rick is moving it very slowly. He has to do a 180 before we can put it in a telescope. This is his first spacewalk, and he's holding that rather expensive solar array. So he was very, very careful and moving it in. So here Rick's on the end of the arm moving it into the telescope. And it's amazing that an 800-pound array can be held by just a little clamp at the telescope. But of course, everything is in free fall, so the forces are very, very low. So Nancy's driving the arm to put the new solar array on. Once we had it on and bolted down, we deployed it like a book. And the new solar arrays are smaller, but they're generating about 20% more power. And that's really important because now we can operate more than one solar scientific instrument at a time. This is the coast of South America. We're actually flying over a number of very famous observatories there. And this is the new look of Hubble with the new solar arrays. Instead of that gold solar array panels that we used to have, we now have rigid arrays. The other nice thing that these rigid arrays have done is they've decreased the jitter in the telescope by a factor of 25. So it can see even more stably now. At the end of the second day, we replaced a couple of momentum wheels. And these are big gyroscopes that store up momentum. And that's how the Hubble Space Telescope points from one star or one galaxy to another. It doesn't have any thrusters. It just stores up angular momentum in these wheels and speeds up or slows down the motors so that it can point to different parts in the sky. This is just what the view looks like when you're working, 20 feet above the payload bay. All the life on the orbiter is in that little cabin there, except for the people out in spacesuits. For the third spacewalk, my suit sprung a leak before we went out, and it was kind of a critical day. This was the make or break for the Hubble Space Telescope day, and you can see the water being mopped up there. So we got kind of a late start. For the first time in 12 years, we were going to turn all the power off on the telescope and replace a power control unit, a fuse box on Hubble that was malfunctioning. So we had to take my arms off and put them on Jim's suit, and actually my suit arms, and then go unplug the telescope. And this is that power control unit, and this is one of the few boxes that was never designed to be changed by people, and so they asked us to do that. And it has all these connectors, and you couldn't get your hand in there to take the connectors off. But we managed to get all the connectors off, swap the old box for a new one. You have to tether to everything that's small so you don't lose it, especially in this case. And my biggest fear was not that I wouldn't get all these connectors back on, it's that once I did, they'd try and turn the telescope on and it wouldn't start up. I don't think anybody's ever turned a satellite off all the way and brought it back up to life, but we did that. I was very happy, took one last picture for a postcard of Hubble before coming in. And those first three EVAs changed the power system. Finally, on the fourth, we were ready to put the new scientific instruments in, on the fourth and fifth. And that's looking inside the pressurized volume. And what we did was to take out the faint object camera. This is a camera that was built by the European Space Agency. ESA contributed about 15% of the cost and equipment for the Hubble Space Telescope, so they're an integral partner in its current operations and science. We took that faint object camera out. That's the last of the instruments that was launched with the telescope. Now everything has been replaced at least once. And we took out the advanced camera for surveys. It's actually got three cameras in it. I'll describe that a little more in the slides. But Jim Newman took out that camera. It's about 800 pounds and put it in the telescope. And you can see he's being very careful with it because it's about a $60 million digital camera. But it is an amazing camera. That's hooking up the connectors for it. And then we put the faint object camera back. And you can see how easy it is to manage these very, very large objects as long as you move them slow. Any inputs you put into it, you have to be prepared to take out as far as moving or rotation. We started also at the end of the fourth spacewalk. Each of these spacewalks lasts about 7 hours, putting in a cooling system to bring the near-infrared camera back to life. The Earth's atmosphere has a lot of water vapor in it, which is a good thing, and it absorbs infrared light. So the Hubble has an infrared camera being above the atmosphere that helps us extend our vision in the infrared. It also gave our commander a chance to fly the robotic arm. And we were putting in some boxes that have an amazing cooling mechanical cooler in it. There's a little turbine in these boxes, three turbines actually, that are about the size of a pinky, that are turning at 450,000 RPM on an air bearing. And it's a turbo alternator, so we're using the heat in the detector to drive this little alternator and then dissipating that heat in a load, the electricity in a load, to extract heat from the instrument. And then radiating that heat with a radiator, which you'll see on the next day, out to deep space. And we've been able to get the detector down to 70 Kelvin, and we're operating it at 75 Kelvin, which is sort of its optimal design point. Infrared light is to look at warm bodies, so you want your detector very cold. That was Jim waving goodbye to planet Earth at the end of his second EVA on this flight. I'm coming out of the telescope there, and this is sort of my reminder that this is the Hubble Space Telescope, and when I was inside the telescope, for a moment I had to think, you know, Hubble used to go inside the 200-inch telescope and look through it. You know, this is about as close as I'll get to that for the Hubble Space Telescope. Unfortunately, the door was closed on the aperture, so I couldn't really look through it. I'm holding a radiator there. It's about 3 feet by 12 feet, and it's an ammonia system. It works kind of like the radiator on your car, and it rejects the heat from that near-infrared camera out to deep space. So we put that on. Jim Newman's from San Diego, and so he called that my surfboard. But actually, on this mission, I got to be not only a telescope repairman, but also a plumber, because we had to plumb all of the lines through the bottom of the telescope in a vent hole that was designed to let the air out during launch. And the designers of this equipment figured new and novel ways to put things in the telescope that nobody had thought of before. So we had to struggle through some of that. But we did all of our plumbing and tidied everything up, and at the end of the fifth EVA, finally got to close the doors on Hubble. And then we had to put all our toys away. We had about 200 to 300 specialized tools for Hubble, and finally we got a chance to say goodbye to the Hubble in person before retreating into the airlock. We see 16 orbital days per Earth day, so we got to see lots of nice sunrises and sunsets. You'll see a little more of that in a minute. Mike got a chance to fly the robotic arm as well to grapple the telescope in the payload bay. For all of the servicing operations, it's fixed to a structure inside of the payload bay, so it's rigid while we float around on it. But when we want to get rid of it, we held it high above the payload bay, orbiting it at about 350 miles above planet Earth. And then Nancy let go of the telescope. We're flying in formation again, traveling 5 miles a second, and then Scott, our commander, fired the jets on the shuttle and we backed out underneath it. And for whatever reason, the Hubble is so big, it's about the size of a school bus, and going over the windows there, that everybody instinctively ducked. But then we realized Hubble was on its way and we grabbed the cameras for a photo frenzy to get the last pictures before Hubble drifted off. And there's some good things. The door is open so that it can see things. The antennas are deployed, so we don't have to go out and do the Jerry Ross thing. And again, we're going to watch its distance. We don't want to hit it. Orbital mechanics, of course, brings you back unless you do burns to stay away. And so there was Hubble all fixed up after 5 days. And, you know, there's no question, you know, as an astronomer, this was, you know, a very neat thing to be able to go up and visit a telescope in space. After we got rid of Hubble, and it was just a star on the horizon, we got to have a half a day off to do important things. Anything that's not tied down in the space shuttle or on Velcro, there's Velcro everywhere, will float away. Exercise is really important here on planet Earth if you want strong muscles and bones, and the same thing is true in space, only more so. Mike is from New York, so you'll see Mike's always talking. And there he is getting his exercise. I like to eat upside down in space. Some people like to eat sideways. Mike did a good job that day, so we gave him a nut. Here we are again flying over the coast of South America. This is the Atacama Desert. There's going to be a new big array of telescopes, radio telescopes down there sometime in the near future. It'll be really interesting. Somebody asked me, do I like floating in space better or taking, you know, looking at planet Earth, taking pictures of planet Earth? I had to think about that one, and you know, then I realized after a few days you kind of get used to the floating around, but you never get used to looking at planet Earth. It's so beautiful. Finally, it was time to come home. We did a 0.1G burn. It seemed a lot bigger. Nancy didn't have her seatbelt on. And then we got into our pumpkin suits again. And all of the energy that it took to get to orbit in 8.5 minutes, we dissipate over about an hour and a half of free fall hitting the atmosphere. So what you're seeing there is the shuttle encased in a plasma fireball at about 2,000 degrees. We're ionizing the air as we hit it. It reconnects behind the orbiter at a couple of thousand degrees hotter, and we don't know how far back, and I'm not sure we really want to know that plasma reconnects. We entered over the United States in the middle of the night. We set off virtually every car alarm in Orlando with a sonic boom. And that was an infrared picture of the orbiter showing how hot the carbon tiles are on the bottom as we come in. There's a view through the pilot's heads-up display showing how high we are and how fast. We come in at over 300 miles an hour, put the gear down. The gear's nice and cold. So are the windows, which is a good thing. That's by design. We're still doing almost 300 miles an hour here at 50 feet over the runway. The pilot helped make this movie, so we get to see the landing 3 times, night landing. And it's always amazing to me that the space shuttle, which is a rocket to get to orbit, a home and a laboratory in space, when we get ready to come back in, we do our deorbit burn over Australia, and after that we're a glider, and we hit a spot 200 feet wide in Florida after traveling halfway around the Earth. So after traveling about 4.45 million miles, 165 times around planet Earth, we rolled to a stop on the runway at Kennedy Space Center, having upgraded the Hubble Space Telescope, and I'll show you some pictures. It's pretty neat how capable the Hubble is now. We did achieve more than 10 times improvement in its discovery potential. And everybody on the ground was so happy. The NASA administrator, Sean O'Keefe, was there to greet us. He shook my left hand because that power control unit task was all left-handed. And I happen to be a lefty. Now, we also had the distinction of having the tallest and the shortest astronaut in the astronaut corps. I'll let you figure out which one is which. And one final salute. Okay, with that, I'd like to transition to the slides. So if we can switch the inputs. And Lars gave you a great introduction, but there's some background that links me to the ITP sort of indirectly. Very tangentially, let me put it that way. But I started out as a physicist, and at MIT I was working with a professor there named Ken Brescher, who's now at Boston University, and Phil Morrison in cosmology. And in fact, we were looking at the expansion of the universe and trying to look at it at high redshift and to determine what the curvature in the Hubble law was, and some modeling of that. And when it came time to apply to graduate school, I applied to a number of graduate schools and kind of narrowed it down to the University of Chicago and UC Santa Barbara. And it was at the same time that the ITP was formed, essentially. And you know, I probably have my history wrong, but it was 1980 when I started, so it was 79 that I was applying to schools, and I think that was right about the time that this was being established. And I thought that was a very exciting concept. And obviously, it's been very successful, so it was a very exciting concept. And Ken Brescher told me that to be a good theorist, one time in my life I ought to do an experiment. And I didn't think that was all that great an idea, actually, but I listened to him, and I went and I worked with George Clark in the X-ray astronomy group at MIT and did my undergraduate thesis building a detector system for a balloon gondola to look at X-rays from Hercules X1, which is an X-ray binary pulsar. That kind of set in motion, you know, virtually the entire rest of my life, because I continued to do experimental physics, and I didn't come here to do theory. And I'm pretty sure that if I'd come here to do theory, I wouldn't have become an astronaut. But also, all of those tools that I learned, working on experiments and the real-time operations and launching balloons, was the best training I could get to be an astronaut, because there I was on the Hubble Space Telescope, essentially doing the same kind of things. This is my reminder to tell you what a remarkable world we live in. First of all, that we have all these great telescopes up there and discovering all these things. But for flight, we haven't hit 100 years yet that humans have been flying in powered vehicles. In astronomy, I think this is just the most remarkable time to be alive. People thought, when Hubble was around, it must have been very exciting. And so to put it in perspective, when Hubble was observing on the 100-inch telescope, we still didn't know, it was a little before this, but we still didn't know that we lived in a galaxy, and we still didn't know that those fuzzy blobs were external galaxies, and that we lived in a universe filled with galaxies. That was all just kind of being figured out, and we certainly didn't know that we lived in an expanding universe. And of course, we had solutions to potential universes from general relativity, but no real observational data to support that we lived in anything that resembled the theory. I'll come back to that a little bit later. This is our official crew photo, and being the payload commander, I had certain liberties, like picking what the type of photo would be, and since it's a Hubble mission, I decided we should have some astronomy in it. And so we took this picture, and it wasn't until after the picture was actually approved by headquarters and made into lithographs and sent out that I then told the crew that, in fact, this particular ESO galaxy is a gravitationally warped galaxy, and that I didn't mean anything personal by it. Let me go back to that one just for a minute. There's one other thing that you probably should know, just because it's kind of fun, is Scott Altman, many of you have probably seen before. How many people have seen the movie Top Gun? It's some B-movie with some famous actor who lives in Burbank. That was shot on real United States Navy aircraft carriers and with real F-14s. However, Tom Cruise did not fly any of those F-14s. They had four Navy pilots, of which Scott Altman was one of them. In fact, there's a scene where a guy's coming into the aircraft carrier and he's lost whatever those Navy guys have, and he's flying really bad, really poorly. That was Scott flying those scenes. And so that's one badge of distinction he has. The other is that I don't know how much Tom Cruise made on that movie. I think it was probably a lot. But the movie company actually paid the Navy for the aircraft hours, a fee to use the aircraft carrier, and they paid the pilots as well to fly those scenes. And Scott made $24 a day. Space shuttle launches are very dynamic, to say the least. I mean, it's an incredibly violent event when those solid rocket motors light, and it's just a big kick. In the Saturn V rockets, they kind of took off slowly and built up speed, and those solid rocket motors generate so much thrust that you really leap off the pad, and it feels like you got hit by a train or something when you're in a little car. When you first leave the pad. By the time you clear the tower, which is about 300 feet tall, you're doing over 100 miles an hour. Of course, you go supersonic pretty quick, going straight up, and this is just a picture. We've gone through this cloud layer, and we're illuminating those clouds from our solid rocket motor exhaust. For the first 90 seconds, it's dynamic enough that a human could not take control of it, even in principle. You just don't have, the brain doesn't work fast enough. The amount of time it takes to transfer signals to your hand is much too slow. So the computers are entirely in control. In principle, after 90 seconds, up to 2 minutes, you could take control and control the shuttle. And that's partly because you're out of the atmosphere and the aero forces are gone. But I'm not really sure that that's possible. We train it, but I'm not sure it's possible. After that, we probably could. The other amazing thing is we get to orbit, after all that shaking, and we open the payload bay doors, which have our radiators and radiate our heat to space, and things aren't floating out. I mean, here we have all these optical instruments and solar arrays, and you sort of expect that they would get all broken up and that little pieces would be floating out. Of course, it's all tested and acoustically driven to make sure that that's the case, but you know, there's just sort of that nagging doubt, you know, that everything's going to hold together, and you open the payload bay doors and it looks just normal. And then of course the other thing is, you know, you look out and there's that, you know, beautiful Earth and that thin blue line that's our atmosphere. And there's no question that you really do appreciate the spacecraft Earth kind of approach, that, you know, everything we breathe and everything we do, you know, is contained in that thin line. You kind of have to take care of it. My commander, when we visited the President of the United States, George Bush, mentioned that to the President, and he had a very interesting reaction. This is the old look of the Hubble Space Telescope. This is sort of the classic, you know, view at sunset or sunrise. You can't really tell the difference in the picture of the solar rays being illuminated by the light. That's because it's made out of something called kapton, which is a gold color, and it's transmissive. So it's just beautiful. And I took this picture. It took, you know, taking the camera and holding the shutter down, because the sunset or sunrise only takes about 30 seconds to get just the right picture, because we were going to change the look of the telescope dramatically. And we did that in our spacewalks. The spacesuits are spacecraft themselves. This is an umbilical only while we're in the airlock. We take that off, and then it's a self-contained spaceship. In the backpack, we have our own oxygen. We have a cooling system. That's the one that leaked, to keep us cool, because our body generates heat. We have to reject that heat. Batteries. We have a lithium hydroxide cartridge that absorbs carbon dioxide, so we don't get high levels of carbon dioxide. We have camera system. We have lights. We have four lights so that during the night we can see. And it's really bright. You don't even, you know, think twice about it working through the night. And of course, communication systems, little computers that telemeter things like our heart rate and all the suit parameters. And you know, one of the neat things about going outside of the space shuttle in a spacesuit is I actually, when people ask, can say, I do work in a vacuum. And so here we are working in a vacuum, putting the solar rays away. As I told you, we typically have one person who's attached by the ski binding-like device to the robotic arm, and that's to hold the heavy things, and one person who's floating free. And here's actually Mike putting one of the solar rays away. The other person, in this case it's me, floating free, and that gives you more mobility and a little better angle on things. And so typically one person will be the free floater and the other person on the arm. So here we are installing one of these rigid solar arrays on the Hubble Space Telescope. The telescope mirror is actually about this level. The scientific instruments are down here. The electronics are around the outside, and there's some more electronics here. And then this is the light shield that prevents stray light from getting into the telescope. This is Mike and Jim exchanging those gyroscopes. And this picture is kind of my teamwork picture. It's like some of those motivational posters that you see. And it's just my reminder that we work together outside, and our lives depend on each other being there and keeping an eye on us, but also just to do the tasks. And then there's five people inside. The person inside, one of them is a spacecraft choreographer. So in this case, I had a checklist, and I was making sure these guys did the right thing. And of course, on the ground, there's hundreds of people watching us. It's not like we're alone up there. There are people at consoles watching all of the orbiter particulars and making sure that, you know, we're not at additional risk due to mechanical problems with the orbiter. And then there's hundreds of people who are watching the Hubble Space Telescope. It's worth a few billion dollars, and they want to make sure that it's operating properly while it's attached to the shuttle. So it's really a huge team, and something like 10,000 people at the Kennedy Space Center who helped launch us. Okay, so that beautiful picture of the Hubble with the gold solar arrays, well, this is about the best it will look now with these rigid arrays, because they're not transparent or translucent, they're solid. In fact, this panel is a spare Iridium satellite array. NASA got them at surplus. So we got a deal on them. And so we have iridium satellite arrays, gallium arsenide arrays, and this is what the Hubble looks like now at sunset. This is actually on the third spacewalking day. We put shades over the light star trackers because at this point Hubble has no power. It's all turned off and we didn't want light to get in there. We put some thermal covers elsewhere on the telescope because while the telescope was unpowered, it was getting cold. So we had a window of only a few hours to finish that connector task, or Hubble would get too cold and wouldn't start back up again. Now, some of my colleagues in the astronaut office have actually said that this is a picture of me going for a cold beer inside of the Hubble refrigerator. And you know, in case you'd heard that rumor, I just wanted to spell it as absolutely untrue because the Hubble refrigerator is actually over here. This was my potential nemesis. And when we started this project for this servicing mission, they asked us if we could change this out. There's three different buses. You can think of it as three different outlets on Hubble that provide all the power that go out to all the scientific instruments and the electronics. And one of them had a problem that potentially could end Hubble's life early. We wanted Hubble to last as long as it could. So they asked, can you change this box out? And so we went and figured out ways that we could do it. You had to do it in one spacewalking day. And eventually, because this was risky enough, they put it to Dan Golden, who was at that time the NASA administrator, and asked him whether we should swap it out or not. So he called me into his office, and with myself and the associate administrator for space science, had a nice chat with us to find out whether it was really possible to change this out and to discuss the risk to the telescope. If we weren't successful in getting all these connected, we'd lose the telescope. If we left it in, we'd probably lose the telescope. And so he gave us the go to try. And he didn't hesitate to also remind me that, you know, we were going up to work on a several billion dollar space asset, as if I didn't need more pressure. Because, I mean, clearly as an astronomer going up to Hubble, I knew I had to fix the telescope. Because my only alternative was to go to Bolivia and go into hiding. Certainly couldn't show my face at any meetings. This is a picture that I took of my partner Rick after we completed that power control unit change out, that fuse box change out. And just to give you the perspective, one of the things that when I was a senior research fellow at Caltech is, you know, I always felt like, wouldn't it be great to have an office with a good view? And you can't get a better office than this with a view like that. You can see reflected in Rick's helmet is planet Earth and the space shuttle and the Hubble Space Telescope. And it's just a remarkable environment. It's also an environment of contrast because we have these cloth suits. I may not have mentioned that, but this is just between 13 and 20 odd layers of Gore-Tex and rubberized cloth and then a vacuum. And then the shuttle is also covered in this white cloth. And that's to reflect the sun's rays so that you don't get really hot. And then the blackness of space. During the daytime, you can't see stars just because of the high contrast and your eyes closing down. At night, you know, I have to admit to stealing a glimpse while I was out doing the spacewalk, and yes, you can see lots of stars. This is Jim holding the advanced camera for surveys. It was built by Ball Aerospace. They've built a number of instruments for the Hubble Space Telescope. And it actually has three cameras in it, and I'll show that a little bit later. But so Jim's just holding on with his hands to that $60 million camera. And it is an amazing camera. It's a 16 megapixel camera for people who are out shopping for little cameras. You know, for about $1,000 you can buy a 4 megapixel camera, but it doesn't scale very well to space instruments. Here I'm holding that surfboard radiator, and again, you know, just the contrast that, you know, here I am focusing on not letting go of this radiator, and 350 miles below we're traveling at 5 miles a second somewhere over the Pacific. It's a pretty neat place to work. Rick and I took some time at the very end of the fifth spacewalk to thank everybody who had contributed to the mission. And I thought it was appropriate when we did our little speech that we raise our gold visors so that people could see that there were humans inside of the spacesuits. And the camera was right here, and Rick was supposed to look at the camera, but he was looking into the crew cabin with the sun on the orbiter's nose. So he kept holding up his hand to try and block the sun out. And we gave our little speech, and he's wearing a mirror on his wrist. And it just happened that he kept flashing the guys inside, and they couldn't figure out what he was doing. So he got a lot of grief about that when he got inside. This is a picture of a sunset. This is with a long lens, a 400 millimeter lens on a 35 millimeter camera. So it's only a little portion of what you actually see and in great detail. And so the sun obviously is on the horizon. You can see these clouds here. These are in the foreground, and that's probably about 50,000 feet. And beautiful, beautiful colors in the sunsets. This is the first quiz of tonight's talk. And there's actually two correct answers, but which hemisphere is this in? Yeah, southern hemisphere. Now, there was a threat to me making it here today, and either it's the southern hemisphere or I flipped it since, you know, with Photoshop. But in fact, it is the southern hemisphere. This is a tropical storm in the South Pacific. We had a hurricane in the Gulf that came very close to Houston. And Lars really was very persistent, and the ITP was trying to get me here. I had a Hubble mission that was in the way, and then a lot of bureaucracy to making it here. And then I just couldn't believe it on Sunday when the track showed that this hurricane was going to hit Houston. But I'm here, so I'm happy. I threw this in because I think it's of some cultural interest, as well as politically current interest. This is the Middle East. And this is the picture that we showed our president in April of this year. And he had some very interesting things to say about this region that I can't repeat here. but it was very clear from our discussion that he was very interested in aggression in this region. And I find that somewhat fascinating. From a geological perspective, you can see that the Earth is very aggressive here. There's a rift in the earth that you can see here, and another one here. In fact, it goes all the way through Africa, all the way to Lake Victoria. And in this case, the seafloor is spreading, and new crust is coming up and being formed, and it creates these mountains where it gets squished. And over here, so it's geologically a very active region. So that kind of explains how all of this looks. And of course, Santa Barbara is also kind of a geologically sensitive zone. But that's geological timescales, you know, millions of years, tens of millions of years, hundreds of millions of years. What I think is so fascinating is over human history, the last recorded history, 5,000 years or so, Babylonians on, this region has always been an area of conflict. And it's a very tough place to live. I mean, look at it. This is all desert. There's not a lot of water here, a little there. There's a lot of green right here. You can tell where the wealth is. But it's just interesting, why has this always been such an active region of conflict? And then this is the thin blue line that my commander, who's a very strong Republican and a Navy commander, and I don't know what came over him when he said, and what always strikes me about this picture is, you know, the thin blue atmosphere. And President Bush said, what do you mean? that I can repeat. So you never know, you know, maybe that made a difference. You know, that's coming from a life member of the Sierra Club, so. This is the Galapagos Islands, and so if you ever are in space, and I hope some of you get the chance to go to space, if you see islands with volcanoes and one looks like a seahorse, you know, that's how you learn Earth geography from space, because you go over things so fast, you know, you gotta figure these things out, and so we actually take courses in this. But it was pretty neat to see this, and I kind of think of Darwin on the Beagle as, you know, learning about life on planet Earth. You know, it was a terrestrial voyage of exploration. And then I think about the Hubble Space Telescope, and it's about everything else in the universe. So that's a pretty broad instrument. And it really is just a beautiful telescope. I think some of the newer telescopes that are coming online look funny, but the Hubble looks kind of classical. You know, the next generation space telescope won't look really cool like this. And it'll be different. And very, very exciting. But we have an asset in space now for exploring the universe that is really tremendous. And I want to share some of the slides that describe that. First of all, let me tell you about the new camera for the more technically minded folks, which may be all of you. But the Advanced Camera for Surveys has three cameras in it. It has a new wide field camera, and that wide field camera is the 4 megapixel one. What that means is, 16 megapixel. It's 4K by 4K, 16 million pixels. And it's about twice the area of the previous camera that was in there. There's also a high-resolution camera. It's a 1K by 1K chip, you know, if it were in a digital camera. And you might think that that's very small, but it's extremely sensitive. It can see in very, very dim light. And then there's a solar blind camera. And what that means is if it filters out the kind of light that our sun produces. And you might say, well, why would you want that? Well, if you want to look at things in the ultraviolet, for instance, this has the ultraviolet sensitivity in this new camera. And it also has a coronagraph. So if you want to look at a star somewhere, Hubble can't look at the sun, it can't look at the moon, those are too bright, but it can look at planets and stars and galaxies in the universe as long as it doesn't look too close to the sun or the moon. And if you look at a nearby star, you can put a little occulting mask over that star and see if there's anything around it, like a disk that might indicate there are planets or planets forming. So that's what the coronagraph can do for you. It can also look at things like aurora on Jupiter using that ultraviolet capability. It has filter disks. That's part of the standard tools for astronomy to look in different colors. And in fact, all the Hubble pictures you see are typically three exposures. So if you want to see a Hubble picture that looks as if it were what our eyes would see, they would use a red, a green, and a blue filter and combine them. And so that's what you'll see. We expanded the discovery potential of the telescope a factor of 10, and it's pretty simple to understand. For the wide-field camera, which has taken most of the really pretty pictures that we've seen, about 1 out of every 10 photons that hits the detector is lost. It's just not very efficient. And that's just the technology that was available when it was built. For the wide-field camera on this new instrument, about every other photon that hits the detector, or at least 1 in 3, is absorbed. And the detector itself is just bigger. And so those two things combined are what allow you to see so much better. Now this is a comparison shot. It's not really dramatic, but it shows that old camera, the wide-field planetary camera, and the new high-resolution camera. And when you look at these two images, they look very similar. And you might say, well, what's the big deal? Why did we go through all this effort and risk human lives to put this thing up there? And the subtle answer is that if you look at these spots, they're slightly better resolved in the new camera. In fact, this high-resolution camera is the first one that takes advantage of the Hubble's superb optics. It oversamples the point spread function in the parlance of astronomers. So these are smaller dots. That allows you to see more detail. It's also a lot more sensitive. Now this is a picture of something called 47 Tucanae, and I like this because it's a hotbed of pulsars. And it's very interesting from the high-energy astrophysics perspective. But the really exciting thing is that it took 14,000 seconds of observation to get this picture and 660 to get this one. And they're roughly the same pictures. And what that means is that a lot more observations can be made of things, and you can just learn a lot more. It's about 20 times faster in the near UV. So that's very exciting. That's a new tool. And this exceeds the specifications that were put on the detector. The next thing I want to show you is from the wide-field picture, wide-field camera. And this is a picture of two galaxies that are interacting. It's called the MICE. And for obvious reasons, it's, you know, bodies and tails, and I don't know. Astronomers like to call things by names rather than numbers when they're really pretty. And these two galaxies are involved in a kind of cosmic dance. They're colliding with each other. And these collisions are, for the most part, collisionless. Stars aren't hitting stars. It's the gravity from one galaxy grabbing the other and spinning them around each other that's tidally disrupting them, just like tides on Earth, and sending these streams of material out. And I have a little cartoon simulation here with only about 1 million stars. Each of these galaxies probably has 200 billion stars in them. So it's kind of naive to think that we could do something with 1 million stars, but here we go. And for those of you from the ITP, this is a tuned calculation. And so when these galaxies collide, it's pretty easy to reproduce that kind of tidal disruption. But what's more interesting is what happens afterwards. So here they go. And essentially, they coalesce into a common galaxy core. And of course, these were old, relatively mature spiral galaxies. But what you end up with is an elliptical galaxy. And so, you know, this may explain why we see elliptical galaxies with evolved stars in it. But it's also kind of interesting to us because this is what we're going to look like with the Andromeda galaxy in just a short time. In fact, we'll do this kind of dance with Andromeda before our sun swallows the Earth in about 4 or 5 billion years. And it'll be pretty neat because Andromeda will get really bright and really big in the sky, and stars will go zipping by. Oh, it'll be fascinating. Just kind of zooming in, this is just to sort of showcase, if you will, the capability of this new telescope. As these things go around, there's a lot of shocks and tidal disruption, and in galaxies there's a lot of hydrogen, stuff that was left over from making all the stars, and shocks running through them are creating hotbeds of new star formation, these very hot young stars. And hot young stars, like rock stars, you know, burn out quickly. So this is a relatively short-lived phenomenon. You can also start to get a sense of sort of the 3D nature of all of this, you know, dust lanes in these galaxies and the halo of stars. And just playing with the contrast a little bit. And you can download all these images and put them on your desktop and play with them. But it's really just striking now, all the detail that we can see in these galaxies and study them. In the old days, you know, a ground-based telescope picture of something like this, old days meaning, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. Now this would be a PhD thesis. You know, just this one interaction and studying it and modeling it. And, you know, now in this picture there's lots of interesting things, so I'll sort of get to that. This is called the Tadpole Galaxy. And again, it's, you know, a galaxy. It has, there's actually two galaxies here, but it's another collision. It has a couple hundred billion stars in it. And this area here is a little rogue galaxy, a dwarf galaxy, that is colliding with this spiral and causing it to send out this long streamer of gas. And in that streamer, again, shock waves and compression are causing areas of star formation. And these areas of star formation may well become other, they'll separate over time, you know, another probably 100 million years and this stream will be gone, but these guys will be left over and they can go collide with another galaxy and it'll look just like this. So this is pretty interesting that's happening. You can zoom in on these with this new capability and really see all kinds of interesting detail. Here's that dwarf galaxy right in here. It's been tidally disrupted as well. And now you can really start to see this 3D nature of these galaxies. You know, definitely, from interpreting this just visually, it looks like this dwarf, and we've verified that spectroscopically, it's kind of coming in, not coplanar with the galaxy. And of course, all that gas. Now, I'm ignoring the stuff in the background for a moment, because I want to show you this picture. And you know, it'd be fun to turn that light off for a moment so you could see more. If that's easy, go ahead. If not, that's okay. But here's sort of the grand picture. This is the one you can download in the same resolution as the best resolution that the telescope can take. And before I tell you really what's in here, my favorite picture from Hubble used to be something called the Hubble Deep Field. In that Hubble Deep Field, Bob Williams, who was then the director of the Space Telescope Science Institute, which is the facilitator for Hubble observations, had director's discretionary time. And he had saved up his director's discretionary time, and he announced he wanted to look at a blank region in the sky for about 10 days with Hubble. And people really thought he'd lost it. Because why would you want to take the world's most valuable telescope resource that's oversubscribed 8-to-1 of people who want to use it to people who actually get to use it, and look at a blank region of the sky from the surveys. And there was good scientific rationale, so it went ahead. And that's before my time, so who knows, maybe they were just humoring him. But in that, you know, essentially blackness of space with the deep exposure from Hubble emerged galaxies, lots and lots of galaxies, 1,500 galaxies in that picture, in fact. That was 10 days of Hubble observation time. That's very expensive. This picture was 8.3 hours, and there's twice as many galaxies. I'm going to show you this. It's easier to show you the stars. So this is a star in our galaxy. You can tell because it has a little cross on it. That's an artifact because one of the mirrors in Hubble has support structure. That's a star. That's a star. You can kind of help me. That's a star. I think that's about it. Everything else in this picture, obviously this is, but every other speck is another galaxy with hundreds of billions of stars in it. And to the same significance as the deep field, there's over 3,000 galaxies in this picture. And computer algorithm that went through and counted over 6,000. And some of these are, you know, really red ones are very far away, they're redshifted. And a program has started to go and analyze that. And again, PhD thesis-wise, this would have been, you know, a major project for a student, you know, and now, you know, this is two and collections of galaxies. I mean, this is now obviously my new favorite picture. It's just remarkable.
And
this picture is about the size of, if you hold your pinky at arm's length, and you don't have too huge a pinky, a little bit smaller than your fingernail in the sky. So again, this is just a really small part of the sky. Hubble will not be in orbit long enough to map the entire sky at this depth. I think somebody made a calculation that's like 200 years or something like that. So just imagine, I'm going to pick some speck at random, but you know, this speck right here, not the laser pointer, but that speck has, you know, a couple of hundred billion stars in it. Okay, now one of the other things that we've learned in astronomy in the last few years is that lots of stars have planets around them, in fact, several planets. We've done that by watching the star motions. And if you, you know, assume some efficiency that's relatively high for the number of planets, well, that means that, you know, if every star only had one planet, there'd be hundreds of billions of planets. But probably stars have more. It's probably more like the solar system, maybe not Earth-like planets, but, you know, there could be trillions of planets in every one of these specks. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. So this is very, very cool. So the Advanced Camera for Surveys is reaching the Hubble Deep Field depths in 1/12th the time, twice as many galaxies. And one of the exciting things is, because we can now see more things, one of the things we can do is revisit the same region of the sky periodically, maybe every 6 months. And then we can look for supernova in these galaxies. You know, if we look and there's a bright spot, you know, sitting right there like the laser pointer, we go, aha, supernova. And that kind of comes back to the KITP here, in that, you know, I mentioned that in Hubble's time, it was a very remarkable era because we discovered, you know, a la Copernicus, that we live in a universe filled with galaxies and that we don't really have a special place in the universe. You know, we are one of many galaxies and we are, you know, it's just very neat that we can look out and see all of those. And it's kind of like the Polynesians, I think. They have a ancient cosmology that says, you know, the Earth sits on a turtle. Yeah, of course, then you have to ask, well, what does that turtle sit on? And they say another turtle. And, of course, you have to ask, you know, what does that sit on? They'll say another one, but it's bigger. And finally, they'll get frustrated with you, and they say, it's just turtles all the way. And, you know, as far as we can see so far, it's just galaxies all the way. Although, as we look further back, we're starting to see that some of these ancient galaxies, ancient because it just took a long time for the light to get here, in fact, about 13 billion years in some cases, some of the galaxies are starting to look funny, distorted, not very well formed. So with Hubble and with this camera, we think we'll be able to actually start seeing the epoch when galaxies started to form in those very primordial galaxies where there are no more turtles. But one of the things about looking for supernova in these galaxies is that we can use them as a distance measure, and then we can measure the expansion of the universe. And many of you probably already know this, but the universe is expanding. And that's kind of a fact, that the universe, we observe it to expand. And the question is why. That's what people here study. And recent observations have shown, in fact, that the universal expansion is accelerating. And, you know, that's something that's allowed by general relativity, but it's not philosophically very appealing because it doesn't fit in very well with a Big Bang and inflation and then just normal physics. And right now the interpretation is, due to the observation that Hubble has contributed to, that the universe is accelerating, goes back to another exciting reason why it's fun to be here at the KITP and also why it's fun to be alive in astronomy right now. 4 years ago, if you were to ask an astronomer, do we have a pretty good grasp on the fundamental laws of physics and what the universe is made out of, they would give you kind of a standard answer. They'd say, yes, we have a pretty good idea that the universe started in a Big Bang, that to account for all the observed phenomena, it had to expand really fast in a very short time, and then kind of settle into the slow plotting expansion that we see now, and that we understand the basic four forces of nature, and we can reconcile three of those, and we're working on gravity. And then from about 1998 to today, we've realized that in fact most of the universe we have no clue how it works. About 75% or so, between 2/3 and 3/4 of the universe is made up of energy and or matter that we have no clue what it is. And that's what's driving this acceleration of the expansion. And the people here, many of you know, are right in the thick of things. A little bit closer to home, just some fun pictures. This is something called the Cone Nebula. This is a ground-based picture. It's called the Cone Nebula because from the ground it looks like a cone. This is still from a pretty big telescope. And these stars are emitting ultraviolet light, illuminating gas, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, silicon, magnesium, that's in this nebula. How did the gas get there? Well, there was a supernova explosion at some previous time that injected it all, as it did before the Earth formed, that accounts for us. And there's a really high density region here, and so this is a shadow. So we can't see any of the gas being lit up because this is shadowing those bright stars. And this is pretty close to home. And this is like the Eagle Nebula picture from the previous camera, so this is kind of a comparison. But it's just beautiful stuff. I mean, the detail in here and the plasma physics and shock physics and just its appeal as a work of art. I mean, it's pretty incredible. And what's going on here, we think our stars are being born. This is a stellar nursery. And so there's some embedded young hot stars that are emerging in here, and probably some planetary disks as well emerging, and you can see all kinds of neat structure in there. And you know, interesting things going on almost everywhere you look. It's just very, very beautiful. Now, the other thing we did on this mission was to bring the infrared camera back to life. And so this is a zoomed-in picture of one detailed area at the tip of that cone, those bright stars that you saw, and all these veils of emitting atoms. And this is the view in the infrared. And what the infrared allows you to do is to see through dust. It's just, it doesn't scatter. And all of a sudden, all these things pop out. Now, we don't know whether these are background stars or whether these are some of those hot young stars just emerging from star birth. It's one of the mysteries of astronomy that we don't really know how stars are born from. It's sort of intuitive. Okay, you have a ball of gas, it collapses, it forms a star. But the details are still elusive. We can also look inside of galaxies. Here's a visible picture of a galaxy. Well, this black line in the middle of the galaxy is not because there's no stars. It's because there's lots of stars, but there's also a lot of dust, so we can't peer into the middle of the galaxy. When we go to the infrared, we can start to see into the middle of the galaxy, and ooh, lo and behold, we see this big disk, probably a disk of star formation right near the center of the galaxy, where there's probably also a massive black hole. And when we look in hydrogen light, in H-alpha, it really brings out that contrast, and we can see, you know, penetrate into the galaxy. So this will allow us, these are new tools for us to understand how galaxies work. And my favorite subject, or one of my favorite subjects, is gamma ray bursts. And it's a whole other lecture. But suffice it to say that this is a galaxy at relatively high redshift, very, very distant. And this bright beacon in super high energy X-rays suddenly went off. It only lasted about a minute. But there was an optical transient that Hubble was able to catch. And this is just sequencing through the time slots that we see. Actually, here's the gamma ray burst, and then over time it disappears. And we still don't know what it is. This is the second most energetic explosion in the universe that we still don't have a clue what those are either. I mean, after the Big Bang, gamma ray bursts are the next biggest thing, and folks here are probably looking into that too. We, you know, current guess is it's probably some kind of strange supernova phenomena, but there are lots of other theories, and again, that's a whole other talk at how we arrived there. People used to think it was in our backyard, and now we find out they're at the edge of the universe. A physicist in space. So here I am working in a vacuum, and this is really the end of the talk, except that I wanted to tell this audience, you folks, about a couple of things that I've done in the space shuttle as a physicist in space. And we get to fly things. Personal thing. So I've flown a gyroscope because I wanted to play with it. A little toy gyroscope that you pull the string and let go. But one day I was sitting in the mid-deck, and there's no windows in the mid-deck. So you can't see the Earth. And the orbiter does various maneuvers. And so what I did is I closed my eyes and I sat there for a while holding onto a handrail until, you know, I felt reasonably comfortable. And then I and no rates, so I wasn't moving. I very, very slowly let go of the handrail and brought my arm in and crouched down and closed my eyes. And I thought really, really hard, and I said, can I find where the Earth is? And, you know, in fact, I could not. You know, I'd pretend that I could get a sense, and I'd sort of think of the direction, then I'd go up and look. And in fact, the equivalence principle works. When you're in free fall on the space shuttle, not, you know, you're not experiencing any personal accelerations. You know, it's, you can't tell gravity or anything else. You can't feel any curvature when you're falling in it. And the other experiment I did was when we traveled through something called the South Atlantic Anomaly. It's an area of trapped radiation. We actually get a lot of radiation. I'm considered a radiation worker. And I cannot go into space again for another year because while out EVA, I took a lot of radiation. And so we can, you know, it's OSHA standards essentially. And what we do is I think we triple the OSHA standard and that's all we're allowed to get. But I had a former life as a cosmic ray physicist. And so I thought, can I also be a cosmic ray detector? And so one night, I set my watch so that I would wake up when I knew we were going through the South Atlantic Anomaly and where my eyes were dark adapted. So right now they're not dark adapted. In fact, I can see people in the front row. But because of this bright light, my pupils closed down and I can't see anything in the back. In fact, everybody might have left. And I wouldn't know, and I wouldn't blame them either. If you close your eyes after about 30 minutes, or if you're in darkness, your eyes will dark adapt and you'll be able to see a lot better in the dark, and that's probably an evolutionary thing. And so I did that, but I kept my eyes closed and I sat there as we went through the South Atlantic Anomaly. And sure enough, I started seeing just a sea of tiny little flashes, just little segments of flashes. And then as I sort of extended that, every once in a while I'd see a much brighter flash, significantly brighter. And I saw sort of different categories of them, and for the aficionados in the audience, and I think all the little teeny flashes were the singly ionizing protons, and probably a few secondaries that were created in the shuttle, but a lot of singly ionized stuff. And the bigger flashes were probably carbons and oxygens, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. The signal was more consistent with that. And also I saw a really, really big flash, and whether it was iron or something going right through my retina, I don't know. But it was very, very rare. I've only seen that about two or three times. And so, in fact, people are also cosmic ray detectors as a physicist in space. And I tried to describe all of this to my spacewalking buddies and such, but I think it was somewhat lost. So with that, I will close and take a few questions. Thank you for your attention.
So if you have questions, ask, why don't you wait till I give you the microphone?
Can you make a few comments about trash? Do you take back to Earth everything that you replaced? Is there any trash at all that you leave to be burned up in space?
There's sort of two perspectives on that, and I'm going to give you the space shuttle story, okay? Because the space station, we have an International Space Station in orbit now. People have been living 24/7, 365 for 2 years now up there, and they have a different trash problem than we have on the shuttle. On the shuttle, we carry everything we bring up, we bring back. That's the plan. And one of the things I'm very proud of on this mission is, as spacewalkers, we didn't lose anything. There's always a risk you lose a tool. We're tethered to them. But on previous missions, occasionally something gets untethered or loose and disappears and will burn up. On the first Hubble servicing mission, they were forced to throw away a solar array. It took about 4 years to deorbit. And that's just the residual drag of those few collisions with the air. You know, the atmosphere goes out really far. It's nearly a vacuum. But on this mission, we brought everything back. And so I was very proud of that. From the spacewalking side, now almost everything. There are things that we vent overboard, gases. And so you can't really count that. I mean, when we fire one of our jets, we're generating chemicals that go out. But the solar UV ionizes them instantly and breaks up all the molecular bonds. So, you know, it all came from the stars. We send it back to the stars. The solid waste, human solid waste, I don't want to go into too many details, but human solid waste we all bring back. Liquid solid waste we dump overboard, mostly water, and again, it gets vaporized, literally. In fact, it comes out as a snowstorm, and we get to see all the particles drifting away and slowly sublimating off into space when the sun hits it. And it's very important not to leave trash in space because it makes it uninhabitable for other vehicles and people. And
You indicated that after you released the Hubble, you ran a couple of thrusters, and I'm wondering what that did to Hubble, or what might it have done to Hubble.
We actually do have folks who do a lot of analysis on that to determine. We have a digital autopilot, so when you push the lever that fires the thrusters, it actually tells the computer to fire the thrusters. It's not a direct linkage. And so we design a trajectory where the thrusters don't point at Hubble. And the folks who designed the shuttle in the 1970s were very, very clever. There's thrusters in the nose and in the tail that allow you to go forward and back, just little maneuvers, very small thrusters. And somebody figured out that if they cant them slightly, so they're not aligned with the axis of the shuttle, that if you fire them at the same time, their forward and aft thrust cancel, but you get a little bit of a down thrust. And so with Hubble sitting here, we use the forward and aft thrusters, fire those, and that separates us away. In fact, mostly we fire the forward ones, and so the nose of the shuttle drops down and it goes aft, and that's why it went forward. So we actually don't plume the Hubble. Yeah. That would be bad.
You obviously have enormous training in physics and astrophysics. I would have thought that most of the skills that an astronaut needs does not call on those. So I'm interested to know whether this is a very different type of work, or whether your scientific training you used constantly, or whether it was more of a physical, intellectual training exercise.
There's a couple of answers to that. Given enough time, you could train a chimpanzee to do what we did up there, in principle. But in practice, things like working on a balloon payload on launch day, you know, reaching into the gondola to adjust some connectors or to, you know, open and close valves, real-time pressure, understanding the instrument in great detail so, you know, you kind of know what you can do and you can't do. You know, all of that training to do experimental astrophysics, which is electrical engineering, mechanical engineering. It's not strictly speaking physics, but it's the tools of an experimental physics. Those things I definitely brought into play continuously throughout all the mission planning, designing the tools, helping them design the instruments so that, you know, they were compatible with humans putting it together in space and operating it. But from the astronomy side, there are a lot of things. Again, it's experimental, but one day I was thinking about our operations and realized that the bottom of our boots were covered with a silicone RTV, a room temperature vulcanizing rubber. And I thought, you know, we really don't want to be putting these boots or our gloves inside the telescope. Well, you can't avoid it. Because if you even put a monolayer of these things on the Hubble mirror, you'd absorb all the ultraviolet light that hits the mirror. And the mirror is looking out to deep space. I mean, that's the whole point. So that mirror is going to be a very cold surface, and you're actually going to condense any volatile organics on that surface. And so that training as a physicist to understand basic chemistry and the thermodynamics and the absorption of ultraviolet light in this case came into play to think of something that nobody had thought of before. And so that's sort of a tangential aspect, but it turned out to be a very important one. Because when we did some tests, in fact, it's true. Even a monolayer of that stuff would be very bad. So we had to change our spacewalking operations so that we kept our boots outside. And we took the gloves and we baked them at high temperature in a vacuum to drive off all the volatile organics.
Can you tell us about the radiation you're exposed to?
Sure. It's I don't want to make too big a deal out of it, but you know, when you're in the Earth's atmosphere, when you're on the surface of the Earth, the Earth's atmosphere is a great shield. And it may be very tenuous, but it's very tall for the radiation. Now, of course, we're continuously bathed by radiation here on planet Earth. Cosmic rays are hitting the top of the atmosphere, they're showering, and so we're bathed in muons and pions, you know, all the time. And we've evolved this way, and apparently it's not harmful, you know, at least for, you know, 100 years or so, but and it, you know, may have driven evolution. But when you're in space, you're above that atmosphere, so those you're getting the initial cosmic rays that come in. Plus, the Earth's magnetic field is a great shield too. It bends the cosmic rays, and when you're traveling around the equator, a lot of the low energy stuff gets bent towards the poles, and the shuttle is at 28 degrees inclined to the equators. Hubble is at a high enough altitude that we kind of get out of all that protection, and so we're facing the brunt of the cosmic radiation from the sun, from the galactic cosmic rays, And so it's just that exposure that's much higher than we would experience here on planet Earth. So in the course of doing three space, oh, and the spacesuits are cloth, whereas inside the shuttle we have, you know, a couple of centimeters of aluminum of stuff all around us, and that's another good shield. So when we, the worst is when you go outside. So we carry little dosimeters with us, and they develop those after the fact to tell us what we got.
I'll ask you a question. The next generation space telescope is going to be in solar orbit, L2. So two questions. One, do you plan to go up there? And more seriously, what do you think, given your experience, about doing that, putting it where it can't be serviced?
You know, the really wonderful thing about the Hubble Space Telescope, to avoid your question, is that we have gone up and we've done four very successful servicing missions. And each time we've gone to the telescope, it's come out as a much better instrument. In fact, I think it's arguable, potentially, but the Hubble Space Telescope is probably the most productive scientific instrument of all time. And the number of things that we've discovered, I tried at dinner to kind of make a shopping list of things that it's discovered, but we've watched comets hit the surface of Jupiter, which is neat. I mean, as long as it's hitting Jupiter, when it looks like it's going to hit Earth. We do storm forecasting, hurricane forecasting on Mars, which is sometimes better than we can do on planet Earth. We've discovered numerous birthplaces of stars, and the observations may lead to our understanding of how stars are formed. We've confirmed the existence of black holes. That's a biggie. And we've learned that almost every galaxy has a supermassive black hole in its center. I mean, it's pretty big stuff. This dark energy cosmology, I mean, this is, you know, the biggest thing to hit physics since quantum mechanics. I mean, it's, you know, potentially, you know, an understanding of that may provide us a link to unify all the fundamental forces plus whatever this extra one is. And who knows what that will enable. I mean, all the fences are down on that. One of the most exciting things I think the Hubble has done that the next generation space telescope will be able to do is somebody very clever realized that there was a planet. We've been discovering these planets. We know of about 100 extra solar planets, planets outside of our solar system in our solar neighborhood. And there's a big planet about the size of Jupiter, and it's inclined so that it goes right around the star and goes behind the star. So it's not going around, this is the star, it's not going around this way, it's going around this way. So there are times where the planet is behind the star and we don't see it, and there are times where the planet is in front of the star, and the little planet actually blocks out a little bit of that starlight. So if you look at the light coming from the star, occasionally it dips just a tiny bit, 1%, comes back up when the star goes out. And that's really neat. We can see that the planet's a big planet. But what's more interesting is that using the Hubble Space Telescope, somebody really clever realized that the starlight is going to go through that planet's atmosphere. And some of that starlight's going to be absorbed. And you can look at the spectrum, break the light into its components, and figure out what the planetary atmosphere is made out of. So from planet Earth orbit, we have actually looked at another planet in another solar system and determined some of the constituents of that planet's atmosphere. And I think that's just incredible. One, that just the existence proof that we can do that says that with better telescopes we can do even better. And the opportunity to look, for instance, for oxygen around an Earth-like planet, you know, I think is great, because as far as we know in normal chemistry, you can't have a planet with a stable oxygen supply unless you have life. Now, we may find out otherwise, but at the moment that's what we think, so we can look for oxygen or ozone, perhaps. But what if we're doing that and we see fluorocarbons? You know, you can't make fluorocarbons in nature. You can make a lot of things in nature, but fluorocarbons happens not to be one. Well, then at least you can rule that planet out from having intelligent life. Now the next generation space telescope is going to be like Hubble, but even more so in that it's bigger, more sensitive, but it's an infrared telescope, so it doesn't do the broad-based science. But it's going to be it'll do a lot of interesting science, a lot of breakthrough science, and it may be the key to understand this dark energy. It's going to be looking deep into the universe. But it's not serviceable by people. It's going to be sent up on an expendable launch vehicle. It'll get to orbit. It'll deploy a big mirror, multi-segmented mirror, a big radiator, and it'll go out to this point that's well beyond the moon. And hopefully it'll work for about 5 years. That's the hope, or the planned lifetime. Hopefully it'll last even longer than that. If something goes wrong in the deployment of the mirror or the radiators, well, then that's it. And, you know, NASA and the science community did a big analysis to determine, should we make it serviceable? And the answer was no. Now, there are other follow-ons. There's a mission called the Space Interferometry Mission that's going to be looking to examine solar systems and the details inside of galaxies and around black holes, and another one called Terrestrial Planet Finder. Hopefully it's a descriptive enough name that it's going to try and find Earths around nearby stars, essentially. And those are going to be very big, multi-billion dollar spacecraft answering fundamental questions in the space science endeavor. And the discussion is currently going on. I'm involved in that right now. I mean, yesterday I was in meetings discussing, should we incorporate a way to go service those telescopes to extend their life and even to build them? Some of these things are so large that, you know, no current space vehicle could launch them in a single launch unless they're compacted and somebody goes out there and puts them together. So that's a dialogue we're having now.
I have two questions. When you were free floating, as you call it, outside the spacecraft, are you tethered or are you just truly free floating?
Yes, you're tethered. There's a small stainless steel tether that you try and keep on at all times.
I suspected that.
Yeah.
Second question, in your video you showed a gentleman shaving. What happens to the whiskers floating in the cabin? Are they dangerous or problematic for the instruments?
You sneeze a lot. No. Inside the cabin, we have a pretty strong airflow, and people often ask, what's it sound like in the shuttle? And well, it sounds like fans blowing all the time, because all the electronics, if it ever gets really quiet, you know, then you're in trouble. And so it sounds like science fiction movies. I don't know why. In science fiction movies, you know, you have the spacecraft, and you always hear this sort of low rumble and the hum. Well, that's what it's like in the space shuttle. A lot of that's just air transport. And that air transport helps us in a number of ways. Prevents pockets of carbon dioxide from building up, because without, in free fall, without the effects of gravity, you don't have density gradients that cause buoyancy and things like that. So you could, but also if you're shaving and you get all those particles, it sweeps them away to a filter pretty quick. We also choose razors, electric razors, that try and contain most of the whiskers inside of the volume. And then periodically, usually the pilot, because he's usually one of the first time flyers and he's kind of the maintenance guy, will take all the shavers and line them up and get a vacuum cleaner that has a HEPA filter, and he opens them up carefully, and you see this little cloud of whiskers coming at you, like that. So we clean them. If you shave with a double-edged razor and foam, then everything stays in the foam, and that's kind of the Apollo approach.
To what extent are your spacewalks completely choreographed and simulated in advance, and to what extent is there extemporization per need as you're out there?
There's sort of the normal plan, and the normal plan is on this mission, we choreographed it more tightly than ever before. They asked us to do so much stuff, and it's almost as if the Hubble community targeted me, because if I had been your average astronaut off the street, at some point I would have said, no, you can't add more content. But I kept saying, yeah, that's a good idea. We need that capability on Hubble. We'll figure out a way to shoehorn it in. And so that's one of the reasons why we did more spacewalking hours on this flight than have ever been done before. And also more content, almost by a factor of two. And so we, in order to accomplish that, you know, we spent a lot of time choreographing each activity of each person so it all meshed together well. Now, there was a risk there. If one thing doesn't go right, you know, the whole plan can fall apart in a hurry. So we did a lot of training on contingencies as well. For every hour we spent in space, we spent about 17 hours in a spacesuit in a big water tank practicing, and who knows how many more hours on a tabletop with Hubble models and little people, you know, moving them around, practicing. That being said, though, there are times where things don't go right, and you start eating into your suit consumables. And on the last EVA that started to happen, the radiator wouldn't go on. And just because of the knowledge we have of working with the team that designed it and built it, and all the engineers, you know, we knew up in space we had the tools we needed to respond to that. And it just, you know, added about an hour to the spacewalk.
What's your next trip?
I don't know. I don't know. You know, I'd love to go back to Hubble. I'd do that in a heartbeat. You know, I think just from a very, very personal perspective, going up and making the telescope capable of taking pictures like that tadpole is the most meaningful thing I've ever done in my life. More meaningful than, you know, discovering orbits of binary pulsars, which was pretty cool, and still is. So I would do that again in a heartbeat. I've worked in space. I've spent 45 days working in space. We now have a space station where there's an opportunity to live in space. And so I'm very intrigued by that. If the science content comes up a little bit, you know, I think that would be a worthwhile investment. I'm also working, I mentioned these new generation space telescope concepts where humans will assemble them. And as part of that, we're looking at using lunar resources. And I'd love to go to the moon. So. But it's nice to be in Santa Barbara, I can tell you that.
Well, you know, let's thank John again for sharing. For sharing his adventures with us and showing us the fantastic science that they've produced. And you're all invited to the reception in the common room. And you might even be able to catch John for some other questions in private. Thanks again.
Thank you.